On the Empire Podcast this week, we shall go to the ball, courtesy of our guest, Cinderella director Sir Kenneth Branagh, plus all the usual movie news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is ready, willing, and available to join One Direction at a moment's notice. Or Top Gear, or One Gear, or Top Direction, anything that you, we're just here. Just give us a shout. Call us anytime. 24/7. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast, as ever. I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. It's a regular sausage fest this week. No Helen O'Hara. And I'm not entirely sure there's going to be three of us in this podcast for the duration of the podcast because one of us is on the verge of death. Isn't that right, art house guru Phil Dissemblian?
Yeah, Ali's really struggling.
Really struggling.
Really struggling.
Yeah, Luke, he's looking a bit peaked.
Yeah. No, Ali's
in good shape.
Good shape. You're the one in good shape, so I want to apologise to the listeners for sounding like I've been dragged in from some sort of influenza outbreak in the 1920s.
You can't see Phil right now, but his eyes are watering and red. He's sniffling and sneezing on a regular basis. Basically, if this were a movie, he would be coughing at the beginning of the podcast. there'd be blood in the hanky, and you'd be dead by the time we got to the reviews. Ali Plum is also here, our film fact fiend. How are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks.
Yeah, you okay?
I'm fine, thanks.
I'm a bit worried about being in close proximity to Phil.
Oh, come on.
I think he might kill us. We have a question, as ever. This has been sent in via email this week. This is from Andrew in Bristol. I don't think that's his last name. I think that's where he lives. He says, "Dear Pod," that's us, "what are you..." This is a weird one. "What are your favourite scenes of, of self-surgery, Phil?"
Yeah.
This could be more apt. In film, mine include Blue Ruin and Predator.
Yeah, he sews himself up. It's kind of grim.
Yeah.
And then he has a really, really profound haircut.
A profound haircut.
I don't know if that counts as self-surgery. But it's an interesting question. We're talking about Predator 2.
No, Predator 1. Well, it's actually the Predator that performs surgery on itself.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, when it is injured. And it screams in pain, and that lets Arnie know that it's around and it's pissed off and it's coming for him.
If it bleeds, this is the moment of any film where I look away. I cannot abide it. It's not something I can handle. Anybody actually going, not only am I already in a lot of pain, but I'm going to perform needle and thread based.
Yeah.
If it's a sticky back plaster, fine, got it. Mm-hmm. I'm in.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Or it's rolling up some loo roll and putting some sellotape over it, fine.
Yeah.
But if it's actually taking a gangrenous wound or chopping off a leg or something like that.
What about the bit when they're doing the walk-off in Zoolander and he has his eyebrow plucked? take it. And he's grimacing in agony.
Yeah, that I can handle.
Really? No, that makes sense. It is kind of counterintuitive to watch somebody having surgery performed on themselves by themselves. Do we think
Rambo does it as well.
Rambo does it.
Yeah.
It does. It is a bit gruesome. Of a staple, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's that thing where the guy is just, he needs to prove his kind of
mean man motherness.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just men, I guess, in movies that do it, but it tends to be. I suppose the Charlize Theron in Prometheus, when she undergoes the... Yeah. Noomi Rapace, I'm sorry. I'm getting my...
It's the delirium is setting in.
Yeah, possibly the fever. The C-section bit, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
That definitely counts.
Well, she programs herself in. Yeah. Grimbags.
I'm sorry, there's been so much One Direction news, I'm using the vernacular.
How are you holding up with the news about Zayn Malik leaving One Direction?
What did you just say, Ali?
Grimbags.
What does that mean?
Means grim.
Harry's still there, right?
Well, you know their names. This is good. Okay, how many other members of One Direction can you
name? That's it, Harry. Oh, and now we know about Terrence Malick.
Terrence Malick has left, which is a massive shame. Zayn, he's left. There's still Niall, Harry, Louis, and Liam. There you go. Boom.
Boom. Good job.
Done.
Very good.
Done. Didn't even have to Google that as well. That's amazing. Ali, any more, Ali? Ali Plum?
I honestly run away from them. I am the worst person to ask about this.
How did you sit through 127 hours in the crucial scene in that?
I did not watch it for that very reason.
You still haven't seen it?
Truly, it is my fear. There's that, and accidentally, when you're fly fishing, the hook being caught in your tongue. That is my ultimate nightmare. So anything to do with either that, or sewing yourself up, or performing cutting off your leg because it's got an infection, or gangrene, cannot do it. This is the worst question.
That happened to me once when I was a kid.
You cut off your leg?
Yeah, it grew back. No, I mean, I was standing behind someone who was casting. I think, casting or fly fishing?
I don't want to hear this.
It kind of went, yeah.
Honestly, when I say it, I know it's in a fictional universe. You're saying it happened to my mate.
No, it happened to me.
It happened to you?
It happened to me. I got one in the forehead.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I may be exaggerating exactly how serious it was. And then he kind of like flung me out to sea and then reeled me in. And when I've got a massive one here, and it was me. That may not be exactly how it happened, but it was something along those lines. What about Tom Hanks in Castaway when he needs to have his tooth? Because that's one of the worst ones. Like, you take it for granted, but you're in a difficult situation. You're going to get tooth problems.
Yeah.
And all you've got to do to deal with it is an ice skate, which is still preferable to most of the dentists I've been to in this country, I'll be honest.
It's up there with a scene I mentioned actually fairly recently in the podcast, which was Helen was talking about Affliction, the Paul Schrader film Affliction, where Nick Nolte pulls out. There's a tooth that's been causing him. Have you seen it?
No.
It's a tooth that's been causing him problems all the way through the movie. And eventually he decides that the tooth, which is also functions as a metaphor, needs to be removed. And so he basically drinks a bottle of whiskey and bites down hard. And he just grabs it and he gets a pair of pliers and he's it's in one shot and his face just gets redder and redder and stop the ship and he's like that, and eventually out it comes. That's fun.
That's the most Nick Nolte thing I've ever heard.
I tell you what, I can handle it, and I know it's not like self surgery, but the Terminator popping out bullets in Terminator 2, I can do that.
Yeah,
totally happy with that.
Yeah.
Or peeling his arm back.
Oh, that's a bit like... Ooh,
it's a bit fierce, but...
I'm really squeamish about stuff like this. I mean, you know, the blood test sequence, anything in a movie that involves syringes, needles, or scalpel, like people cutting themselves, like, you know, so the blood test scene in The Thing, which isn't the same category remotely, but there's always a bit where, you know, where they cut into the thumb, and you know it's just a special effect. And you know that there's a little wire going, there's a little tube going up the side of the scalpel that squirts out the blood. But even so, it just every time, that in that movie, with all its grossness, that's the thing that gets me every time.
The scenes I love are the ones where it's a little bit like The Dark Knight Rises, when you go, broken my legs, broken my back, I'm covered in death and blood and crap, but I've got this shatter-resistant ruler, I'm going to sellotape that to my leg. I've got this banana, which I'm going to put just by my back. I'm going to put some blue tack on that. And then I'm going to get myself a nice pot of yogurt. That's nice. That'll make me feel nice. And then I might have a cup of tea, and then I'll go fight a really big monster
back
or whatever.
In action.
But I like those, well, a bit of this, bit of that, MacGyver my body together, and I'm fighting fit.
They are good. And also, as a sort of adjunct to that, when the guy is injured and he knows what he's doing when he goes into Boots or whatever the local pharmacy is, and he just gets all the things he needs.
Yes, I love that.
I'd be like, I've got strepsils, might need shower gel for later, bag of that. I just wouldn't know. We wouldn't
condoms
know what to
just
get.
In case. Yeah,
you never know.
You never know.
You never know. Yeah, that's always impressive.
It's kind of the montage of, yes, you need the second act low point, but you've got the third act montage of improvised surgery.
The pharmacy
smashing
supermarket
grab.
Sweep. And they're always very focused. They don't go, I'll have need some of those ones for later when we're celebrating the fact that I've beaten whatever's maybe injured now with the other stuff that I'm using. Maybe some tranquilizers for my next flight. They were very like, I'm just going to take the things, the iodine and the super painkiller and the ruler and the banana. Except in Boots, they don't stop bananas.
Please, what I do in my boots.
Do they?
Whatever you do, do not perform any surgery based on my, albeit tried and tested techniques.
No. We need to get this podcast sponsored by like the Red Cross.
That would make sense.
I think so. You think so? Yeah, super squeamish. I was watching The Theory of Everything, actually. Mm-hmm. And there was a really squeamish bit in that also reminded me of the really squeamishest thing I think I've seen in a long time, which is in Senna. No, it isn't. It's in Rush, where Niki Lauda has his tracheotomy.
The throat hoover.
The throat hoover thing.
The throover.
Oh, my God. The throover is not called anywhere.
It's appalling. And he doesn't say, hit me, but he does say, like, do it again, don't stop.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He couldn't say, hit me, because his voice is so sore.
Good news, Niki, it's the latest fax. It's the latest Dyson, in fact. It was that's a bad one.
Oh, that would have been bad if he had to do it by himself. Christ.
Self-hoovering.
Yeah.
I just thought of a good one. Master and Commander.
Yes, that's a good one.
Doesn't Paul Bettany have to oversee his
own
surgery?
He oversees his own surgery.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Squeamish. We apologise to any listeners who may have passed out in the middle of that question. Good stuff, though. I like that. I should be watching all those films and throwing up later on.
Remember. Banana, blue tack, bad back, gone.
Ruler.
Simple?
Simple.
Ruler. Simple. Simple.
Speaking of simple.
Yes.
We're not plugging anybody here, but Orange Wednesdays is back in another form. I know that was a thing. We were upset about it, or at least a little anxious about it late last year. And now it's back. It's now called Meerkat Mondays.
Meerkat Movies.
Meerkat Movies, that's
Meerkat
it.
Meerkat Movies.
Because it's Monday and Tuesday, isn't
Tuesday
it?
Wednesday.
Tuesday and Wednesday. Oh, well, I've got this totally right. Well done, me. I'm here with all the news, guys. Chris, take it away.
Yeah, so... So it turns out Orange Wednesdays wasn't actually Orange's thing. It was just something that they sponsored and lent their names to for years. And it was great. And they got loads of people in the cinema. Anyone who goes to the cinema, if you're an Orange customer and you know...
Or mates with one.
Or mate to one. You went to the cinema on Wednesdays. And generally speaking, they would be jam-packed, which would be great to see. And so Orange pulled out last year. You know, Orange have now been taken over by EE, who have then been bought by BT. But we, you know, and then they... But this is actually the cinema chains of... done this, and they sent it out to tender. Loads of other companies came in with pitches, and comparethemarket.com with the talking meerkats, simples, they won by apparently pledging hundreds of millions. That's something I read. Hundreds of millions of pounds of sponsorship over the next 5 years or so.
They love the marketing. Compare the meerkat were willing to really promote it and plug it. From your extensive knowledge, do you have to be a customer of it?
Yes.
You do.
So you have to use their site.
Yes.
And then you get given a code.
Correct.
That isn't as easy as having a mate with an Orange mobile
phone. Is it? However, you can see from their point of view, it's a good thing because it might make people, and this is a weird thing, but it actually might make people consider going to Compare the Market. Look how many plugs we've just given them.
Well here's the thing. They're getting the ultimate advertising boost, which is getting about 18 mentions on the Empire podcast, which is worth approximately in advertising
dollars. £4.50, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Simples. I've done it again.
Stop it.
I've done it again. But I have a slight issue with this. I mean, yeah, Tuesday and Wednesday is great. It's 2 days a week rather than 1 day a week. It's fine. Can I have two tickets to see a film, please? Yeah, sure. Can I redeem my Meerkat Movies voucher? What was that? Meerkat Movies. Yes, I said it. Meerkat Movies. It's.
I know.
They need to change the name.
The unfortunate thing about it is that it's very lame.
Yeah.
It's not that it isn't good. It's just very lame.
Yeah. Mm. Not good.
Well, yeah, till such a point as they make a movie starring the sodding meerkats, then I'm okay. But that's coming at some point.
It's so coming.
Cousin Olag. Simples. Or whatever they do. I don't know. Anyway, if you want to have a question read out in the Empire podcast, you could tweet us. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire podcast. We're on Facebook as well, Empire Magazine. And as Andrew... Yes, Andrew from Bristol did this week. You can email us, podcast@empireonline.com. Okay. Hello, Phil.
Do you know what else you can do?
What can I do?
You can download Viber.
You can download Viber. That's absolutely right. Although you will not be able to submit a question to us on Viber, but we are now on Viber. We have an Empire Magazine chat room, if you use the app Viber, where you can see Phil, Ali, myself, James Dyer, and Nick every day discussing the day's movie news and whatever else pops into our heads. We'll post videos, pictures, not candid nude shots, and other movie-related musings on there every single day.
We are literally trapped in a glass case of chat. And we can't have any interaction with anyone. It's just random shouting into the ether. So if you have anything pressing, come to our office and tell us about it.
Don't come to our office. Don't.
If you throw things at our window.
If you do live in the ether, then you're fine. Because you're going to get all the messages.
This is true. Unless you're talking about the ether, which is the MacGuffin from Thor the Dark World, in which case you're probably possessed by an ancient evil.
Okay, well, either or.
Don't come to our offices in that case. If you're possessed by an evil, ancient or otherwise, just don't come to our offices. Now, at this point in the show, generally speaking, we have the first of our two interviews. We have two guests a week, but we're changing up the format of the Empire podcast ever so slightly for the foreseeable future. Instead of having two guests each episode, we're going to have one guest each episode, each weekly episode. But this is where it gets confusing. We're still going to have two guests a week, but one guest will have their own podcast special. Okay, so this week Antonio Banderas is the subject of our podcast special in a very fun interview he did with Phil back when Phil was still alive. Listen now for that one, which means that this week we have one guest on the podcast, as I've already said, Sir Kenneth Branagh. Okay, does that make sense?
I think so.
If you're listening to this at home and if it makes sense to you, nod now. I think we've got a lot of nods there. That was good. That felt good. So instead of having an interview, we're going to barrel straight into movie news. And God, there's a ton of movie news. There's just so much movie news. Should we start with? Should we? I don't know. Where should we start?
I've got one.
Yeah.
Idris Elba is in talks for Star Trek 3 as written.
Yeah.
By a Mr. Simon Pegg. He may well be the villain, so people are thinking, well, as these Star Trek movies have been dipping in and out and occasionally a little too in to previous Star Trek lore, what Star Trek villain of yore will he be?
The Borg.
I really hope he's nothing. I hope he's totally new.
I hope he's totally new.
Is an entirely new concept, because not only is Idris Elba great, but this is the kind of big franchise. He's been kind of attached to different things, like obviously in Thor he is his own little thing, but this would be a really good chance to see more of him in a big action blockbuster, which isn't Pacific Rim.
I agree. I don't know why I said it in that accent, but I agree. Yeah, absolutely. I spoke to Mr. Pegg about Star Trek a while ago, and he said that they want to do new stuff. They want to actually have the Enterprise boldly going where no one has gone before. Which would be interesting, and not just stick around Earth, which is what they largely did in the last movie, and not just mine Star Trek back catalog for the greatest hits.
To be fair, if they went to Baltimore, that would be pretty cool.
That would be awesome. Big Driss, as we know him on the podcast, we love him. Lufa! So why not?
Be a good villain.
This brings me on to my next story.
Is it Lufa?
Lufa!
Lufa! Lufa!
Stop it.
Lex Lufa!
You, Jesse, where were you on the night of the 15th?
I was kicking Superman in the shins.
And then running away.
For somebody whose name is Luther, doesn't often say his name a lot, just like casually.
He does, doesn't he?
Luther.
Does he?
No. Is it one of those things like the, don't you throw your bleeding spears of British TV in the last couple of years? Like, it's something that he's never really said and that we've just created for him. I mean, presumably, why would he ever say it?
Never,
maybe.
Other people might say it. It's John Luther.
I'm sure he said Luther.
Who's that? That's John Luther.
I'm sure. I'm sure.
You think?
Put a 25-minute supercut together of him bellowing his own name from the how many episodes? 10 episodes of that TV show there have been over the last few years. It's just a one-man play where you go, Luther!
Anyway, Jesse Eisenberg. Luther. We saw the first image of the ball, Jesse Eisenberg. Mm. Yes, that's our story. But you'll have to look it up. He looks really intense. It's another black and white shot from the iPhone 6 of...
Zack Snyder says he is different from other Lex Luthors, but I imagine he's pretty much exactly the same as Lex Luthors as the previous ones. Although it has to be said, Gene Hackman obviously played the role as with a comedic bent, and Kevin Spacey was kind of in between. So it didn't really work when he turned all evil at the end and started literally shivving Superman with kryptonite, which is what he does at the end of Superman Returns. I imagine this Jesse Eisenberg version will be more sinister and...
What else do we know about it? Dan Jolin had an interesting theory, a sentence I'm not moved to utter that often, about the last one, which was that he thought that the LexCorp would end up being part of the reconstruction of the city that had been laid waste to at the beginning of the end of Man of Steel, which I thought was quite an interesting one. The idea that actually... this is a man that's kind of ingrained within the fabric of the city.
You see the signs of LexCorp on the skyscrapers.
So maybe that's something that will... Yeah, you do, don't you?
Yeah,
so,
in the fight scene on top of the not finished building, it's got LexCorp all over it. So it makes a lot of sense.
It does. I guess if I'm... Yeah. Without getting all highfalutin, the idea that you have a big sort of corporate magnate is quite ingrained in sort of American... culture, isn't it? So he's got an interesting villain for the time. That was really wanky.
No, it's true, but so there must be people out there who must be looking at Lex Luthor and going, why is that guy just punching the good guy? Why is the guy in the blue cape, the red cape and the blue tights punching the good guy? There must be people who look at Lex Luthor, entrepreneurs, ruthless entrepreneurs who've stabbed people in the back to get to the top.
With kryptonite.
It must be looking at Lex Luthor as some sort of
hero.
Shining light.
He's a hero.
Yeah, he is a hero in many, many ways.
He created Viber.
He did not create Viber.
And if he'd invented Viber.
He probably has his own apps, though. Yeah, but I mean, he's part of that sort of American industrialist tradition. And I like that as a comic book idea. It's clever and it could be interesting.
I don't know
where Batman's going to fit into it, though.
Well, this is the thing. It's like also Lex Luthor obviously has no powers whatsoever apart from his big old brain and his even bigger bank account. So how can you set that guy up? And this is a problem that they've struggled with historically. in films, certainly. How do you set that guy up as a credible foe for the man who can kick the world into the sun? Speaking of things that we can't show you because it's a podcast, but that are definitely out there for you to look at, the teaser trailer and poster for Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, as it is now called, debuted last week to great acclaim. In fact, debuted on Monday. The full trailer debuted on Monday. And I think I really like this. I think it's going to be fantastic.
It looks like the same old, but even better.
Yeah, really fun hook, which is that the IMF are battling an evil organization, the anti-IMF, as Simon Pegg says in the trailer, doing his best Sid Ivel Gold voice. So that's kind of fun. I like that. It's also essentially the plot of Spectre, so you can see why they may have brought Spectre, Mission Impossible, forward ahead of Spectre. So maybe we didn't really consider that. We at the time when they moved it forward from December to July, we didn't consider that. Hang on a second. We thought they were moving away from Star Wars.
Yeah.
Well, actually, what they might have been doing was going this on paper at least has a relatively similar plot to the big Bond movie. Maybe we should come out first.
I reckon there's going to be a scene there where he hurts himself and then has to fix himself with a ruler and a...
That'd be amazing.
Sellotape.
Yeah.
I suppose the biggest talking point is what we saw, like kind of paparazzied. Of course, we didn't see it. Someone told us about it. We're better than that. That Tom Cruise essentially stapled his hands to the side of a plane, just went for a ride because he was too cheap to pay for the airfare. No, he was doing this insane stunt.
Yeah.
Where he literally holds on to a military plane as it takes off. And apparently they had to do it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times because they needed to get the shot. Yeah. They were so worried that there'd be bird strike.
Yeah.
Not on the engine, on Tom Cruise. Yeah.
The burnout rate amongst the people that work for the company that insures Tom Cruise must be huge. Just the stress levels.
What's he done now?
Whatever you think about Tom Cruise, he's up where? Oh,
I can only insure you if I don't know what you're doing.
He's tunneling to the center of the earth with his bare hands. Oh, Tom.
He's surfing down molten lava without socks on. I mean, whatever you think about him, he does his own stunts. And
guys,
they are crazy.
Got some bad news. Tom Cruise has discovered Atlantis. He's also in need of an air supply. But seems like a typical...
Yeah. But I mean, you know, full props to the guy. It's the era when you can have stunt doubles and CG stand-ins and whatever you want to do. And he insists on doing his own craziness.
Bring, bring. Hello. I'm on the moon. Tom, what are you doing on the moon? Get off the moon, Tom. Do you have a helmet? No!
I'm in my pajamas!
How did you get there, Tom? Took the tube. Oh, Tom.
Where does my phone go? Bring, bring. like it's a Fisher-Price telephone.
Hello, Tom Cruise's beleaguered partner. Hello, how may I direct your call? Oh, it's Tom again. What have you done now?
I'm inside a lion's mouth. Oh, again? How did you find a lion big enough? I bought one. Oh, Tom.
I'm fighting Hydra.
Thomas.
Anyway, so yeah, he was on a plane. It's such an iconic moment they've decided. Actually, it is. It looks fantastic and it'll probably go down in history, but the poster is him hanging off the plane.
That is that you know the 1 minute teaser trailer for the teaser trailer came out the day before the trailer, and it ends with that shot, and the teaser and the trailer ends with that shot as well. And I think that shot, more than anything, just makes you go, I need to see this film now, because that's amazing. When you saw the pap shots, because it was in the Daily Mail, spread them all over the Daily Mail a few months ago. When you saw the pap shots, it was like, you don't really appreciate exactly how batshit insane that is. I mean, it's more insane than that incredible shot of him sitting on the top of the Burj Al Khalifa in jeans and bare feet with no rope to tether him.
He did have a phone, though. Bring, bring.
Bring, bring.
Hi, Steve, it's Tom. You'll never guess where I am.
I'm
yes, I
roof.
Will. are you clinging to the sun, Tom? Yeah.
Sorry, I can't get reception here.
But that shot, more than anything, because the camera is stationed on the plane, and you get an idea not just of the speed he's going at, which is very freaking fast, but also the sheer height of the plane as it takes off. And you just know that, yes, we know he's strapped in with wires that have since been digitally erased, but you know that if, yes, a bird hits him or a young man, you know, fires a balloon up and, you know,
there's a really
he just
heavy
falls
gust
off,
of wind.
You know, there's no more Tom Cruise.
No more Tom Cruise.
So, Yeah.
It's a bit nuts.
It is a bit nuts. And what can he do for the next one?
Well, if you look at the image on the plane, when you actually look at the paparazzi shots, it's not, you think, oh, it's just a camera, like a big IMAX camera. Because of aerodynamics, it has to be this rounded thing. It looks like, if you remember CNA in like 1993, they had those security cameras which looked like terrible disco balls.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's one of them, but like super reinforced and, you know, IMAX worthy.
For The Spy Who Loved Me.
Exactly like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, amazing, so that's a bit stuff. Of colour for you.
Amazing.
Can't he use his gloves from the mission in, from the last one?
That would have been
yeah, that wasn't a real
blues.
Thing.
Oh.
That wasn't a real thing, Phil.
God, I was getting mixed up.
Bring, bring. Hello. It's me again. What have you done now? Rattlesnake down my pants. Oh, God.
I've wet myself. What? Oh, sorry, on the moon.
I'm still on the moon. Oh, Tom.
Anyway, there's so much news. We better crack on.
Yeah.
There's another Lego movie coming out, and Jason Segel and your friend and mine, Drew Pearce,
mm-hmm.
of Iron Man 3 writing fame.
Yes. Who's involved in everything at the moment.
Yes, he wrote the script. This is my segue. One of the scripts that became Rogue Nation. Is that right?
Yes.
There we go. So, segue. Haha. They're doing another Lego movie. This now means that there are three. So there's Batman, there's Ninjago, and the sequel.
I always say Ninjago, but that's wrong.
And here's another one, which is called The Billion Brick Race.
Yes.
Which presumably would involve a lot of bricks and a race. I hope it's going to be lots of cars, because the Lego cars are always fun and they can get more Technic going on. So I see a Technic movie coming here. Neither of them directed before. They've kind of done little bits, if that makes sense. So that's exciting.
Yeah, that's very, very cool.
Also, Ben Mendelsohn potentially signing up for Rogue One.
Ben Mendelsohn talks. Yes.
And I think Ben Mendelsohn is superb in everything he's in, even the things that aren't so brilliant.
Where do I know him from, Phil?
Ben Mendelsohn. You'd know him if you you'd know him from Animal Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
You'd know him from
Black Sea.
Yeah, Black Sea, of course. He tends to be sort of
The
Dark Knight Rises briefly. Yeah. Yep.
He is Mr. If you want someone to play someone who's slightly sweaty and sociopathic, then Ben Mendelsohn is your guy. He's currently in Bloodline, which is the Netflix series,
he's
which is going down.
Owning
very well.
Bloodline, I would say. Killing Me Softly.
Killing
Them Softly, exactly. Not the Fugees song.
No.
He is really, really good in just about everything. He does a kind of a sweaty, slightly psychotic thing, but I think he can do more than that. I guess you'd look at him and think he may be some form of villainous element in this, mm-hmm. just from what he's done previously, but I'd like to see him do something slightly different, because I think he's got great range and he's a very very, very talented actor and an Australian, one of the best Australians out there at the moment.
I think he's very good, and I like this casting as well, because it'll piss off Jeff Wells of Hollywood Elsewhere, who has mounted something of a hate campaign against Ben Mendelsohn recently.
He's a very strange man.
Yeah. Jeff Wells, not Ben Mendelsohn. And so that's kind of fun as well. All very exciting news. Other things just very quickly to mention. So X-Men Apocalypse has added another cast member, another X-Man, Jubilation Lee, aka Jubilee, who is a young lady who can fire essentially fireworks and brightly colored crackers out of her hands. She is in the comics, certainly whenever I started reading them, she is a very, very good friend, almost a sidekick of Wolverine. So that'll be interesting. She's played in this one by Ali.
The lady in question is called Lana Condor.
Lana Condor.
Who sounds like a superhero in of herself. But I do feel like there are just so many people in this film. It sounds a bit like Civil War.
Mm.
But who knows? If there's a man who can handle it, it's Bryan Singer.
Absolutely. Steven Spielberg will direct, maybe, because he's been attached to a lot of stuff. Ready Player One, anyone know? Can anyone say anything about what Ready Player One is?
It was written by, it's a novel written by Ernie Cline, who's one of the guys who wrote Fanboys. Do you remember Fanboys with the whole George Lucas thing? So he wrote this book where it's a world where people log on to this online utopia, so kind of a Super Sims, but the Super Sims type game is run by a Steve Jobs type mega businessman, tech folk man. President Super Business. And he dies, and he decides to give his fortune to whoever can complete this game. This massive maze / questionnaire quiz thing. So it's the adventure full of pop culture, hat tips and knowledge and references and whatever, and it needs somebody who can get these little bits of, you know, say it's a reference to Link from Zelda, and then the next one is, you know, something from Jaws. Like, he obviously has one of those in the bag, but he needs to bring together lots of little references here. It's exciting. Nerds who have read the book, geeks, whoever, myself included, are very, very excited about this. So, yes, I agree. He's been linked to so much stuff that this may not happen, but it's a very interesting idea. Do read up about it.
Cool. Also, on Sunday, the Jemison Empire Awards. Oof. The 20th, I believe.
No way.
Jemison Empire Awards take place on Sunday at a top London location, hosted by Jimmy Nesbitt. And, yeah, very exciting. Going to be a cavalcade of stars. And you can check out, obviously, our coverage of that in the next issue of Empire, which is out at the end of April. Or you can go online, empireonline.com/awards2015, and you can see all our coverage from blogs to live tweeting and a live stream of the arrivals before the show begins. I'll be on a patch of carpet. It may not be red, I don't know. And I'll be interviewing all the big names. So do tune in for that. And speaking of Empire, while we're, you know, in self-aggrandizing mode, new issue's out.
Yes, it is.
The new issue is out. New issue of Empire, £3.99 at all good and evil newsagents. What's on the cover, Phil?
Glad you asked, Chris. It's a film called Terminator Genisys.
And how are we spelling that, Phil?
We're spelling it with extra Ys.
Extra Ys. We've resisted the urge to correct the spelling of Genesis. We put Terminator Genisys on the cover. Arnold Schwarzenegger is there as the aged T-800 Pops, alongside Emilia Clarke as the new Sarah Connor. It's all very, very good. And if you check out the iPad edition, you can see an enhanced, very digitally enhanced cover, which is a lot of fun. And we work together with the filmmakers on doing. It's great stuff. And inside, obviously, there's a massive cover feature about the movie. The latest Terminator film with director Alan Taylor, talking to Arnold Schwarzenegger, talking to all the cast members, talking to Emilia Clarke, which then leads us into a massive Game of Thrones special, a celebration of the best TV show that I haven't seen. Season 5 is upon us, and it's just an enormous celebration of all things gamey and throny. We also talked to Kit Harington. We have a celebration of Canon Films, who are the 80s Mad Men, Golem and Globus, who made all sorts of really incredible schlock. Kerry Mulligan is the Empire interview this month as well, which is a lot of fun. There are great set visits from the likes of Pan. We were on set of Pan. There's a great Mr. Holmes piece written by the man to my right, Mr. Ali Plum, who talked to Saria McKellen. There's tons of great stuff in there. A bit more about Neil Blomkamp talking about Alien 5. This month's Pint of Milk is Mr. James Corden, a very, very funny one. Simon Pegg takes us through the best and worst moments of his career. And it's a very, very good jam-packed issue, so do pick it up. £3.99. All good and evil newsagents.
And for fans of Empire Heritage, the return of Script Notes.
The return of Script Notes, yes. Time for this week's guest. Sir Kenneth Branagh has been a bloody legend ever since he was a wunderkind in his 20s, bestriding the worlds of theatre and film like a colossus. His directorial career tapered off, it's probably fair to say, in recent years, but he has returned with a vengeance recently with the likes of Thor, Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit, and now this week's Disney live-action fairy tale, Cinderella, which has been a huge hit in the States. I went along to speak to him last week. I'm delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by Sir Kenneth Branagh. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hi, Chris. I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Excellent, excellent. I've literally just come from the screen room where I've seen Cinderella.
Oh, really?
And I'm still aglow. it's such a sweet, charming, earnest film.
Yeah.
It's a very sincere film. And I imagine that's a tonal decision you had to make very early in the process.
Yeah, it's heartfelt. I'd say it was heartfelt and passionate. Cinderella's mother, as part of her sort of dying words, encourages her daughter to have courage and be kind. And in a way that the film was driven by having the courage to make a film that's about kindness and make it a very powerful thing and a very active thing, and let it be embodied by a character who could express that without seeming, you know, naive or unsophisticated.
You're no stranger recently, at least, to long worldwide searches for, you know, your leading actor in a film, obviously after Thor and Chris Hemsworth and finding him eventually. I imagine finding Lily James, was that difficult, finding the right Cinderella, or did you turn on Downton one day and there she was?
It was inevitably time-consuming because the script was evolving, and what we were after required quite a lot of subtlety on the part of the actress to convey this inner strength, but not to simper, not to be saccharine or sappy, to be smart. First time we see grown-up Cinderella, she's reading a book. We needed to believe that was a girl who looks like she reads books and responds wittily and quick-wittedly around them and to circumstances, whether it's with snarky stepsisters or amusing mice, that you feel a reactive presence, you know, somebody who's in the moment and spontaneous. And she has all of that sense of fun. I mean, her experience on Downton was a great boon to us because you know, she has all that experience in front of a camera, all that experience in front of people like Maggie Smith and Penny Wilton and Phyllis Logan, all these people she's watching and learning from and clearly has. And that sense that she would be able to deal with the responsibility of playing a big part like this in a big movie, no mean feat. So that combined with her ability across a long audition process to still be playful at the end of it rather than crazed and desperate was also a very winning characteristic.
And you have Richard Madden as well in this, and he's fantastic in the film as well, and you've really fleshed out the prince and given him, you know, a background with his relationship with Derek Jacobi's father. But I was just relieved to see him survive a wedding.
Yeah, as you know, he's had problems with weddings in the past, yeah. And we were very careful to keep the colour red away from him during the process of filming this. He got very, very sensitive, very twitchy.
Yeah.
No, it was great to have him and Lily. They have a tremendous on-screen chemistry. And again, you know, Richard benefits hugely from this previous experience of extensive work in front of a camera with a great cast on challenging material. And he presents a thoughtful and considerate companion to Cinderella, who he meets, and she in turn meets him before the ball. There's a sense of two people who don't know each other. They don't know each other's identity at that time, so there's a reality to their initial connection that makes for a belief in the possibility of their relationship. And they do that with fun, and they do it with intelligence and a teasing quality, and just this sort of sense of being right there in the moment. Both of them feel like they're evolving through the movie.
Yes.
And I think that's really crucial and a big tribute to their capacity to act as sort of naturally on film as they do here.
And how far advanced are the plans to reunite them on stage?
We'll be probably announcing something very shortly, but we're working together on this production of Romeo and Juliet, which will be a very exciting adventure for all of us, and just grew out of a kind of natural conversation about a desire to work together again. And so I'm looking forward to it very, very much. It's been really a joy to get to know the pair of them.
And you're going to be stationed at the Garrick for quite a while, is that right?
Again, well, I suppose I don't. In theory, I'm not supposed to confirm a ton of details at this point because I don't want to frustrate people who then try and get a ticket immediately. But I would say that we will very shortly be, revealing details of how that's all without being too coy about it. Just my only concern is to just make sure that when people hear, they know how to get there. It's going to be happening very soon.
And interesting. It's interesting that you may be going back to the theatre for a prolonged period of time, because it feels to me, and I don't know whether you agree as well, but this feels like the second act of your directorial career with movies. And do you feel that way? And do you feel also, you know, with the success of Thor and Cinderella, that there's an element of striking while the iron is hot, and it's interesting that you may be moving away from that.
Yeah, you sound like my agent, who might be saying,
"Oh, do you want to give me 10%? Well, by all means, I'm always happy.
Well, I think, you know, you have to follow, or at least my experience is you have to follow the your creative instincts and try and work out what makes you happy. And a lot of my best directorial work on film has followed extensive periods in the theater. And I think these are three biggish films back to back that I think sometimes it's worth a little period of reflection. Also, sometimes, although great to strike while the iron's hot, I've done a lot of that in my life. But there's also, taking a bit of a moment to also, you know, respond to where you feel you want to go next in terms of scale or, type of material or, all those kind of things. But essentially, you're hoping for either things that you've developed yourself to come to fruition, or that terrific surprise that just gets you very excited and passionate. And I think, sometimes life can be a bit about planning, and sometimes it can be a bit about the surprise. So I'm excited about what we've got planned for the theatre, and the world of film is never excluded, because the whole conversation between film, theatre, and TV is one that's been going on in my professional life from the beginning. So yeah. I suspect it'll go on in much the same way.
Oh, so you've got Wallander coming up as well, which you've filmed those. Those are done.
Yes, we have. Yeah. We've finished the last three. One was shot in South Africa, based on the novel The White Lioness. And then the last one of the novel, The Troubled Man, which is a beautiful, beautiful novel, will be covered by two 90-minute films right at the end of the series, directed by a young man called Ben Caron. who's done a fantastic job. I loved doing them, and it was there was a great sense of satisfaction to get to the end of these novels and these short stories that we've adapted, and in true Henning Mankell Wallander fashion, it is unbelievably bleak and tough and dark at the end of this story. You know, if you see Cinderella and think, well, I see what Ken's doing now, so Wallander's got to be a happy ending. I wouldn't bet on that.
No spoilers, please. No spoilers. But was Cinderella, in a way, a surprise for you? Did it come out of left field?
Did. I just made two films that were very male, and so to have such a clearly proactive female protagonist and indeed antagonist, and for it very much to be a woman's movie, if I can't think of a better way of putting it than that at the moment, but I will, was surprising. And yet, you know, a heightened world in which magic occurs, at the center of which family dynamics are passionate and complicated, I suppose, is maybe not missing from my previous CV. So maybe it wasn't what rocket science for Disney to put that together.
How did it actually come to you? How did you get involved?
It just came out of a clear blue sky, although I knew Sean Bailey, the president of Disney, and I knew Chris Weitz quite well. We'd worked together on a script which I loved, a story I loved, and a movie I loved, which we just couldn't get made.
Okay.
So I'd had the experience of working with Chris, and I knew that our sensibilities meshed, and I admire him very much as both writer and director. And he was a great ally on this because of his experience in both those departments. Very open, and so I was able to have a really in-depth conversation with him as soon as I read the script, and knew that we could, you know, work together on the way I hoped to inflect it. And Disney were very collaborative, and they, you know, they really essentially let me get on with it. You know, Dante Ferretti and Sandy Powell and Kate Blanchett were already involved, and I was very happy about that. And so it began in a way, in the usual way, which is a script arrives, and we might have talked about this before, but I like that first reading of a script that looks like it's an interesting idea to be as ritually calm and separate as possible. I always try and, you know, create an afternoon or something or a morning. I'll go to a quite separate place, you know, either in the house or an office, or I'll go and be, you know, sit in a park or somewhere where I can just be on my own with it and sort of have a pure reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like anybody to pitch it to me. Well, Cinderella is going to be this. Oh no! I want to start from page one. Because I enjoy that feeling. I always think it's that moment, that special moment when you understand whether this could be something you want to do, has for you to be the equivalent of those lights going down in that cinema and that audience. Are they already feeling excited? What do you see when you see page one? You know, is it getting you going or not? And it's I take a lot of trouble over it, because that when it starts to get a bit sticky at various times, which is often, it's good to remember that you were thrilled that morning. When you turned the first page over. And so I really guard that experience jealously.
So at what point do you know a script is going to go either way? Do you know it's going to, within 10 pages, within 20?
Straight away. You know if you're hooked or not. And sometimes when you're so hooked, if it goes astray for 20 pages, you can live with it and come back. If you feel the sensibility is strong and clear, and there's a sort of direction to it, it's very exciting. And you know, conversely, your heart sinks when you just feel, and sometimes you could admire something that's gonna you aren't gonna do, but I'm talking about only a personal reaction to whether you could conceive of living with that thing for 2 years while you try and make a movie of it. Always assuming, which I do, is that you might say yes, and bear in mind, I get this, I might be one of 10 people reading the same script. They say, we're offering this to an exclusive group of filmmakers, and essentially you just, it's really an audition process. You know, I wish I could tell you, oh, they just land on my desk, what do you want to do, Ken? That's not it, that's not how it works.
Okay.
You know, it's, there are too many talented people about, so you know, when it comes that way, it's you know that it's saying yes is just the beginning, you know. Then it's, oh, we're not sure about the budget, and oh, we don't know if we're going to shoot it in Lithuania or Mars, and so it goes on. So that initial reading, make sure you have fun, because you'll need that to sustain you across all the ups and downs of making it.
Do you put together mood boards and presentations when you're pitching for things like this?
It depends. I mean, this was unusual because, you know, the art department work was advanced. So in a way, what had to happen was when I came aboard, I needed to see whether it was I gelled with all of that. And then I did have notes about how I wanted it to change. And was everybody happy about that? And so that becomes just a conversation. So I didn't have to do too much of the dancing this time. And it's a bit simpler for me now because there is a kind of sense of what my sensibilities appear to be, and as far as they can be understood at this point, all the things that you know are common to some of the films that are unlikely to perhaps throw me or that I might be interested in. So even though I think I've got a bit of a reputation for eclecticism, there are also some common themes that mean people usually don't get on the phone to me unless it looks like it's going to be somewhere in my wheelhouse.
No one's offering you Saw 8, for example.
Great script. Very bloody, Chris. Yeah. It's very bloody.
The way everyone dies at the end.
A lot of teeth.
Yeah.
A lot of teeth.
Very strange. A lot of cartilage. Very strange. And one last thing. Cinderella is obviously part of Disney's, and this is a word I promise you, live actionification of their animated back catalogue. That is a word.
What planet's a word from?
It's in one of the dictionaries. But obviously we have The Jungle Book coming up, we have Beauty and the Beast, we have Tim Burton's just been announced to direct Dumbo. What's your take on this policy, this new Disney policy? I think it's fascinating, but...
I think I'd call it a creative direction. You know, they have this unique relationship to fairy tales through their animated... library, so a discussion of those stories and how they work and their kinship with their animation division and with Pixar and everything, that just, as it were, at a high level they understand story and they have a real view on how these stories are told, and you know, they have real experience of dealing with what audiences' expectations are and whether they might try and meet them or change them or move them. And I think Sean Bailey, who's the president of Disney, I think is very, very much an architect of this plan with Alan Horn, the chairman. I think they basically see the chance for imagination to be unleashed by filmmakers. There's a great opportunity for them, and that these are stories that it would seem people wish to see again, and because they become stories that aren't so much to do exclusively with seeing something for the first time, but to reliving part of their childhood, reliving it for their children, with their children, and children with their parents. There's a ritual to it which goes beyond what the films are about, and is to do with the sort of cultural legacy of fairy tales.
And was there any discussion at any point about incorporating songs, for example, about being more slavishly dedicated,
no,
I guess, the original?
I was given a pretty free hand about how to relate, if at all, to the original 1950 animated classic, and it seemed to me a very natural, you know, response from me anyway, to not want to put songs. I knew we'd be heavily musical with a great score from Patrick Doyle, and we'd leave the songs right to the end, and we'd ease up on Mice and Cats with a gun held to my head, but it seemed every woman I ever met when I told them I was doing this said, "Is Gus Gus in?" And by the end, I felt, if Gus Gus isn't in, I'm out. So that decision was made through the power of public opinion.
And how big was Gus Gus's trailer?
Gus Gus's trailer was a subject of real concern because he was one of those mice that really gets out, and he has a tape measure, runs it across the other trailers and stuff. And that wasn't just it. It wasn't just the trailer about which he was bitter and twisted. I'm very sad to report this about Gus Gus. He was, however, assuaged when we really addressed the root of the problem. Usually with actors, it's money or billing or both. And of course, with Gus Gus, it's cheese.
On that note, Sir Ken, thank you very much.
Thank you.
What a lovely man. In fact, today I have to do a 1-hour on-stage Q&A with him. Which is going to be a lot of fun, trawling through the highlights of his career. And that man has had a lot of highlights in his career. And I don't just mean in his hair, like Much Ado About Nothing, but, you know, he's not naturally lap blonde. But, very cool.
Shall we review that film as our first review?
Shall we?
I think it's important before we talk about this film that I set up the plot, okay? So,
Cinderella.
Yeah, be careful.
Okay.
Because this is going to get complicated.
Okay.
An orphaned girl, here played by Lily James, is kept as a servant by her wicked stepmother.
Oh, God.
Kate Blanchett, but shown a way out by Prince Richard Madden and a fairy godmother, Helena Bonham Carter. there's this big gold carriage. She wears a blue dress, cloth slipper.
Mm-hmm.
You know the score. Bish, bash, bosh.
Loafer.
You know. You know how it goes. Tom Cruise explodes. It's a fantastic film.
You've seen versions of this over the years.
I'm au fait.
My favourite is A Cinderella Story.
Good news is that this is a very, very sweet, charming, very earnest, very heartfelt film. I liked it a lot. If leave your cynicism at the door, because the film certainly does. This is not a movie that cocks a snoop at Cinderella or sticks his tongue in his cheek. Although Helena Bonham Carter is a lot of fun when she turns up for one scene as the fairy godmother. It is it's a film that takes the source material at face value and presents a movie that I think, because I'm not a 7-year-old girl, but were I to be a 7-year-old girl, I think this would be my new favourite film. And I think it's going to be a film that is very, very good for families. It's been a huge hit in the States. It also has Frozen Fever, the new short featuring the Frozen characters and a new Frozen song affixed to the front of the movie. So that's another reason to go and go see it. But it's very, very, very well done. Lily James is very winning indeed as Ella. You know, she carries the movie. She's pretty much on screen in every single scene. Richard Madden has a nice little bit of depth given to Prince Charming, who's a character that has literally no depth and has never previously had a name. So the fact that he even has a name shows that, you know, they've advanced this story along a little bit. But Cate Blanchett's having all sorts of fun. They had Cate Blanchett with the budget. They had Cate Blanchett with the costumes, and she does a variety of grand entrances. Her entrance in this movie, I think, is destined to become one of the all-time movie great entrances.
Is it wicked?
It's not.
Is it wicked?
It is wicked, man. It's wicked.
Really like it.
I did really like it. Yeah. She's very, very good in this, and
I'm loving
it. It's just a lot of fun. There are no songs, which you may be delighted to hear, but it just has nice rollicking pace and will leave you with a big old smile on your face.
I would have thought Rihanna would have done the title song.
3 stars for Cinderella, but I think if you're in a certain frame of mind and if you're a certain age, it might even be a 4. Who knows? It's a lot of films to get through this week, and we don't have a lot of time because people are banging on the door about to kick us out of the pod booth. Where should we go next?
Let's go to SpongeBob SquarePants.
Why not?
I have to say, I'm not immersed in the SpongeBob mythos. I haven't really seen the last film, and I, to this point, thought that he was a form of tofu. But this movie is just mental. I mean, there's no two ways about it. I had a really good time. I was expecting virtually nothing, and I came out with a big smile on my face. It's a film that does have its tongue in its cheek. I'm not going to get into the plot. Basically, the subsea kingdom presided over by SpongeBob and his mates. The recipe, the secret formula for the Krabby Patty has been stolen by what I can only describe as some form of almond on legs with eyeballs. I don't know. He's a villain. I believe he's part of the mythos that I'm not really appraised of. And Antonio Banderas plays a pirate who's kind of in a meta way writing the story as he goes. Princess Bride style. Burger beard, thank you very much. Got a big beard. He's wildly over the top. And as we talked about in the interview that you can hear elsewhere, he is having a blast in this film and he carries you with him. The whole thing is entirely deranged. If you remember the beginning of Madagascar 3, which is kind of a Dali-esque dream sequence, that's a whole film of that, really. Mm. It's kind of crazy in a really good way. I mean, we gave it 3 stars. If you're in the right frame of mind, you could even go one more. I would say it is delirious and loopy, and the plot is really neither here nor there. There's just lots of puns, lots of wordplay, lots of ridiculousness and over-the-topness, and I had a fun time watching it.
I'm dying to see this because you described one scene with Matt Berry as a talking dolphin and just had me on the floor laughing just from your description of it, and so I really, really want to see it. So 3 stars for SpongeBob SquarePants. Sponge Out of Water.
The name of the SpongeBob film. Movie, okay. Sponge Out of Water.
SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water. Right, let's move on very quickly to, lots of films.
Next up, let's talk about Robot Overlord, shall we? We had Sir Ben Kingsley on the podcast last week. He's the bad guy, Robin Smythe, in this rather fun, kiddie-friendly fantasy.
Yeah, very much in the spirit of Amblin in the sort of, in the kind of 80s, I suppose you'd say. And it's very likeable. The setup is, as we mentioned, the planet's under martial law, basically. You can't really be outside for more than, I think, 30 seconds before some form of droid flying or kind of walking comes and threatens you with evisceration. Mm. Yeah, a little kind of shades of the beginning of T2, I would say, in the world with less skulls being crunched underfoot. And the kids have figured out a way of, everyone's got a chip implant in their mind, and they've stumbled upon a way of circumventing it so they can go out and not be detected. And from there unfolds a magical adventure as they try to shake off the evil robot overlords of the title. And Robin Smythe pops up with his bow tie and his baseball cap and plays the role of collaborator, effectively. Gillian Anderson is the mum who gets her game on as the movie goes on, becomes more involved in the schemes of the kids. Look, it's very likeable. It's fun. Very 3 stars for me, I would say, which is kind of what we've given it. What would be your thoughts?
Yeah, I'd say so as well. It's, you know, it's good fun. It feels a bit like a slightly bigger budget. It's got good performances all the way through from the likes of Gillian Anderson, Sir Ben, as we've said. Callan McAuliffe, who is an Australian actor doing a very good English accent. I didn't know he was Australian. I had to look him up. As the young hero, if you will. And this one, Sean, you know, decent special effects. It's well marshaled, well written by John Wright and Mark Stay. John Wright, of course, directed Grabbers most recently. This is a not quite the same movie as that, but it was shot in and around, mostly around Northern Ireland, so I got a bit of kick out of seeing places like Bangor and whatnot. So that was good fun.
Yeah,
you know, it's fine. It moves along. It rattles along at a good old lick.
Yeah, the robot design was kind of very 80s.
Yeah.
And the sense of place is quite important, isn't it? It's like a coastal town, so it's got a bit of a Wish You Were Here feel to it in a weird way, somewhere in between Wish You Were Here and Terminator, which is a pretty big space to fill, I'd accept. But yeah, likeable, not epic in scale. I think the Doctor Who analogy is not an unfair one, you know, and it looks pretty decent on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, 3 stars.
3 stars for Robot Overlords. Also out this week is, and we're not going to talk about this one in depth, believe me, but is Seventh Son, which was meant to come out about 2 years ago. And it stars Jeff Bridges, Julianne Moore, formerly of this podcast, of course, and Ben Barnes. And it's a tale of a young sorcerer's apprentice, if you will, a young man who is the seventh son of a seventh son. And he is chosen to become the man who will kill all the evil in a medieval realm. And it's not very good. And you don't really, or you're under no illusions why it was put on the shelf for about 2 years. 2 stars. Also out this week is the latest Michael Winterbottom film. It feels like he's uber prolific, but I don't think he's made a film for about 4 weeks, so I think he's losing his touch. So this is The Face of an Angel, and it is inspired by, initially I thought it was a straight dramatisation of the Amanda Knox Meredith Kircher story, which if you know that, there's a rather grubby story of murder in Italy. You know, but it's not. It's a fictionalised account of a fictionalised murder, which may or may not bear resemblance to the case. Daniel Brühl is a filmmaker who is studying, researching the case, and it begins to take over his life, and he maybe begins to lose his bearings a little bit professionally and personally as it goes along. Daniel Brühl is very, very good in this. So is Kate Beckinsale, and so is Cara Delevingne, which is interesting. She's beginning an assault on the movies, having dominated the world of modelling for a while. 3 stars for Michael Winterbottom's latest. And then, of course, there's Get Hard, the movie which pairs Will Ferrell and Kevin Hart to alleged comic effect. It's got a lot of flack in the States. Some people have accused the film of being racist, homophobic. Judge for yourselves. All we know is that it's unfunny. 2 stars for Get Hard. And that's pretty much it. It's a big old week this week.
Yeah.
And that is it for this week's Emperor Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Ronald D. Moore, who's the creator of Battlestar Galactica and the Amazon show Outlander. Obviously, he did a lot of Star Trek as well. So that's a very fun interview. And our separate podcast interview will be with the legendary Greg Nicotero, who's the special effects genius who went on to become a bastion of The Walking Dead. So he started off in the likes of Day of the Dead and Evil Dead 2. He's a really, really good guy, and is a fascinating interview, so do tune in for that one as well. And don't forget our Antonio Banderas podcast, which is also available to listen to. Until next week, it is goodbye from Ali.
Goodbye to you.
Goodbye to you, Ali Plum. It's goodbye from Phil.
I made it. I'm still here.
I know. I'm honestly surprised. And there's that. That's comedy. That's timing.
That's timing.
That is timing.
You can't buy that.
Phil's just in a
goodbye,
massive
everyone. Apologies for the snottiness.
Pyramid, like a pyramid of Ferrero Rocher, but it's just tissue wrappers.
Yeah. I'm off to catch Phil's cold, I think. Yeah, and it's goodbye for me. I'm off to talk Tom Cruise down from the moon. See you next week. Bye bye.